This is a great week of material. This is going to be a lot of fun. How much of it we get to, who knows? But as I said in my subject line, this week Nehemiah is awesome. There's a lot going on here. Oh, I didn't pull one of the Tanakhs. I think we're on page 1839. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure I need one. I think we're going to be staying fairly local today, so I think it's all right. But thank you. Okay. So we are up to chapter 2, Parbet, Pasuk Yud, sentence 10 is where we are. Nehemiah has arrived in. Well, first of all, Nehemiah has appealed to the king, and Nehemiah has been promised an armed entourage to help him on his way, and now he is arriving in Judea. But before he arrives, we are introduced to a couple of people who we're not going to like very much. Sanballat and Tobiah. So let's talk a little bit about Sanballat in particular, because that's the chief name that we're going to have to deal with. A lot of the information, this goes back to the conversation we were just having, Sharon, a lot of the information we have about Sanballat comes from documents found in Elephantine. And let me explain that a little bit. There was a Jewish garrison, an outpost of soldiers, in Upper Egypt. And whenever I say Upper Egypt, I always have to remind myself that the geography is backward. As a good child of the Northern Hemisphere and the Northeast, my feeling is always that North should be up, right? And not just up in the sense that we orient our compass that way, but North is up and rivers run from North to South, and North is the upstream and it's the higher topography, and South is always downstream and low. Right, that's the way I think of the world. So that's entirely wrong when you deal with Egypt, because in Egypt, Northern Egypt, as you get closer to the Mediterranean, is actually lower topographically, with the result that the Nile runs south to north. It's running from a higher area topographically to a lower area, which makes sense. That's what rivers should do. But the result of that is that when you talk about Upper Egypt, you don't mean Northern Egypt. Upper Egypt means Southern Egypt. So this is a Jewish garrison on an Upper Egypt, i.e. Southern Egypt island, in the Nile. It was called Yave back then, as in Yud Bet. Now it's called Elephantine. And they're there starting about 650 before the Common Era. They are part of the defenses of the Persian Empire. This is the border of the Persian Empire. And the Jews who are there are part of the defense, and they're not necessarily practitioners of what we would consider to be Judaism. And I say that specifically regarding the temple at Elephantine. There was a temple there. It was some sort of a blend of Jewish practices and practices that would be from the outside that we would not recognize. Remember, this is middle of the 7th century before the Common Era. There is no such thing as Christianity. This is a blend of Judaism with various forms of ancient religions that are practiced in that area. It should not shock us that this happens. It happened long before this, in the period of the Shoftim, the Book of Judges. This kind of syncretism where you blend different types of worship, they essentially went native. So they kept some things and they absorbed others. These documents, the papyri or papyri, I'm not sure which one it is, that's the plural of papyrus. I think the papus. What? Okay. These are legal documents. These are letters. And what's been found is basically from the period of the year 495 before the Common Era to 399 before the Common Era. So you're talking about a period of roughly 100 years, right? Basically the 5th century before the Common Era, and they tend to be written in Aramaic. They're discovered at the end of the 19th century. Some papyri had been known before that, but that's basically when the big trove comes to light. And I gave you a link in source number one just to a document available on JSTOR where you could get more information about the discovery of the papyri and their nature. But that's where we get a lot of our information about Sanballat, and it's important for our discussion. Sambalat is going to be Nehemiah's main antagonist. There will be others. We already mentioned Tobiah. Sambalat is identified here as Hachoroni. Sounds like from Horon, which is the way many take it. It means he's from a place called Beit Horon. But his identity is confusing. It's usually assumed that he is Samaritan. I'll bring you one example of this going way back, source number 2. This is from Rabbeinu Gershom, writing in the 10th century. Commenting on the Gemara in Erchin. We learned this Gemara once before. This is the passage of the Talmud that talks about the Samaritans and whether their conversion to Judaism when they were afraid of the lions was a legitimate conversion or not. So he quotes the verse which we saw back in Ezra, in chapter 4 of Ezra, "Dichtiv lo lachem v'lanu livnos bayis," it is not for you and for us to build a house for our God. So he says, who is it that Zerubbabel is talking to? When he says, it's not for you to build a house with us, who is the you? Who he's talking to? Klomar Hanhu Sanbalat Vitovia. He's talking to Sanbalat, he's talking to Tovia. Dahavu Ode Kochavim, they were idolaters. Loinichum Livnosul Hakdish Litzarch Bedekabayas, and they were not permitted to build or to dedicate things for the Beis HaMikdash. So Rabbeinu Gershom back in the 10th century already tells you that Sanbalat and Tovia are Samaritans, part of that group Zerubbabel rejected. As a matter of fact, when we learned Zechariah, which is, 6 or 7 years ago already, when we did Zechariah, we saw the story in the third perek of Zechariah. It's worth taking a look at maybe, but I don't have a Tanakh with me, so I'm just going to tell it to you. It's alright. In the third chapter in Zechariah, Zechariah has a vision in which he sees a representative of Yehoshua, Kohen Gadol, some form of Yehoshua, the high priest, standing before God, and he's wearing filthy clothing, and the Satan is standing there on his right to obstruct him. So commenting on that, Ibn Ezra and Radak say that the Satan is Sanballat. Not that Sanballat is the Satan, but the Satan is Sanballat, two different things. That the image in the dream of somebody who's trying to prevent the success of this new temple represents Sanballat. That's the idea. So he is part of the bad team. In fact, the Elephantine papyri identifies Sanballat as the head of the Samaritans. At least we have from the period of 408 BCE to 411 BCE, and he is placed as the Pacha in Shomron, which is going to be an important point, that he is the political leader in Shomron. Important to recognize that when you talk about him as the leader at that point, the chronology may not quite work, and it is actually assumed that there are, and this goes again back to what we were talking about, Sharon, there's a chain of people named Sanballat, presumably father to son, who control over this period of time. In other words, it's a dynasty of people who hold the position of Pacha on behalf of the Persians. However, having said that he is Samaritan, there is a Jewish identity here. And we will see that. For example, this we won't see in Nehemiah, but we have papyri that talk about his kids, and they have Jewish names. Dalia, Shlomia. So that sounds like he is Jewish. And if you flip ahead for a minute, take a look at Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Chafet, chapter 13, sentence 28, also known as the last sentence in the book. Actually, not the last, sorry. Oh, close to the last. Pasuk Chafet, 13:28. Umi B'nei in the Hebrew, right? And from the sons of Yoyada, son of Eliashiv, who is the Kohen Gadol, Chatan L'Sanballat HaChoroni. You see that? The son-in-law of Sanballat. So for somebody who is a Samaritan, who's on the outs, he's in pretty well, right, in terms of lineage among the Jewish people, his kids marrying into the family of the Kohen Gadol. So the assumption is, and this is what Professor Mordechai Zeir Kavod suggests in the Dat Mikra edition, that he was a Samaritan, but from a family that had accepted Judaism. So even though Samaritans are not biologically Jewish, we know of the attempts to convert, he's part of a family that has joined the Jewish people in some, on some level. And enough so that he's able to marry into successful Jewish families. The name itself, Sanballat, is actually assumed to be Babylonian. It means Sin, which is the moon god, gives life.
Life.
Yeah, Sin gives life. So the he's working with a Babylonian name off of a moon god. He seems to be Samaritan, as the way we've taken him. And there's also some marriage of his family among the Jews, suggesting that at some point they have become Jewish. That's Sanballat. The key thing that we need to come away with is his position of power. Right? The fact that he is seen as the Pacha of Shomron is going to put him at odds with Nehemiah. Because Nehemiah is coming in with authority from the king to build up defenses in Judea, and potentially Nehemiah, this powerful person from the king's court, could take away power that had belonged to Sanballat. Sanballat is no longer the biggest name in the area. So that's something that drives him on this. That's Sanballat. The other person we meet here is Tovia of Ammon, right? Tovia ha-Eved ha-Ammoni. Tovia the Ammonite slave. Well, what do we know about Tovia? So in source number 3, I gave you a reference to a pasuk coming up in Nehemiah. It's Nehemiah 6, sentences 16 to 19. Take a look, please. This is Nehemiah reporting on the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, and how they were succeeding in building the walls of the city. And look what Nehemiah says. Vayikasher shamu kol oyveinu, when our enemies heard about our success, vayiru kol hagoyim asher sivoseinu, all the nations around us saw, vayiplu ma'od b'yeinehem, they fell in their own eyes, those they knew it was all from God. And then he continues to say, Gam bayamim ahem, also in those days, Marbim Chore Yehuda Igrosehem, the Chore Yehuda means the free people of Yehuda, people of standing. They increased their letters, Hochos al Tovia, to Tovia, Vasher la Tovia ba'os aleihem, and Tovia was sending letters to them. In other words, Tovia is of great influence among the Jews at this point. You're calling him the Eved HaAmoni, and it continues for another couple of verses, but you get the idea. Tovia may be called the Eved HaAmoni, which sounds like he's a slave, but he has powerful reach among the Jews of this time.
Yeah. The name sounds like a Hebrew name.
Yeah, Tovia sounds Jewish, doesn't it? Tovia. Right? That's a nice Jewish name. Yeah. No, you're right. It does. It does sound that way. And I can't answer the question of his status, except to note source number 4. This is the Gemara in Kiddushin. You remember way back when we talked about Ezra having identified 10 different sets of lineage among the Jews who have returned to the land. So one of them, we said, were Mamzerim. Right, one of those lineages was the lineage of Mamzer. Mamzer is someone born from a particularly illicit marriage. An incestuous relationship would result in that. Adultery would result in that. So the question that the Gemara here asks in source number 4 is, how do you know there were Mamzerim? Right? Don't tell me in every bachelor's... No, that's not the answer. Mamzeri Menolan, how do you know that there were Mamzerim there? Dichsiv, and they give you a quote. This is from that section at the end of chapter 6. Vayishma, well, first is our verse. Vayishma Sanballat Choroni v'Tovia ha'Eved ha'Amoni. We mention Sanballat, and we mention Tovia, who is the Eved ha'Amoni. And then, the end of chapter 6, we didn't read that far, but the verse is right here. Uchsiv, Ki Rabim v'Yehuda Ba'alei Shuvu Alo. Many in Judea had taken oath to Tovia. Kichatanu l'Shechaniah ben Arach, because he was son-in-law Shechaniah ben Arach, v'Yehochanan beno lakach et bat Meshulam ben Brechia, and his son Yehochanan married the daughter of Meshulam ben Brechia, end of quote, and Kasavar Ove Kochavim Ve'evet Haba Bat Yisrael Havlad Mamzer. And the author of our Mishnah, who thinks there are Mamzerim, says, well, wait a minute, if an Eved marries, someone from Eved's family marries a Jewish woman, or has relations with a Jewish woman, the child is a Mamzer. So that's the assumption of the author of our Mishnah, and that's how he knows there are Mamzerim. But the point for us is, you ask whether Tovia is a Jewish name. Tovia may be a Jewish name, but according to this Gemara, he was an Eved. When it says Eved HaAmoni, it means he is a slave from Ammon and not of Jewish origin. If he is freed at some point, he becomes Jewish. And maybe that's how he got the name Tovia. It could be this isn't his birth name. But according to this Gemara, he is not born as a Jew. That's one way to read the word Eved, and that's the Gemara's way to read the word Eved. However, that's not necessarily what the word Eved means. Eved does not have to mean classic biblical slave under the rules defined within the Torah in Parashas Mishpatim for how you have a slave. Rather, Eved could mean servant. You know, the translations are always very funny about this. You look in an art scroll or a Sansino, and sometimes Eved will be slave, and sometimes Eved will be servant, depending on what you like. It's like this week I was writing the Parsha article for Toronto Torah. Take a look this week; it's a good article. I wanted to quote the pasuk about Yosef that he's Yafei Toar v'Yafei Mareh, and I was curious to see what the art scroll did to translate Toar and Mareh, because they're not easy to translate. So I look it up, and I see that it says for Yosef of handsome form and handsome appearance. I thought that was interesting, and the word handsome caught my eye, because who else in Bereishis is described as Yafat Tor, Yafat Mareh? Who else besides Yosef? Rachel, his mother, is Yafat Tor, Yafat Mareh. So I went to look there to see whether they rendered her handsome, and sure enough, the same Hebrew words, but it says beautiful. Beautiful in form and beautiful in appearance. So you're describing a male as handsome. You're saying, yeah, but the same word in Hebrew. It does not appeal to me to do that. I think you pick one, and that's what you use down the line, and you worry about gender hang-ups later on. Nonetheless, that's the complete aside. What we are talking about is the fact that slave and servant are used as translations for Eved largely based on context. And so some argue, Tovia Eved HaAmoni means that he is not a slave, but rather a servant of the king. He's in the king's service, is the way he reads it. Yeah.
Isn't a Misharet a
servant? Misharet is more personal servant, no? Misharet is like somebody who will be like a valet, exactly, to bring the king his things. I think you're somebody who works at the pleasure of the king, right? Your job is tax collection or whatever. You could be identified as an Eved, but Misharet really wouldn't suit. That's my sense of it, but the truth is I can't prove that I'm right.
Where does it say Eved
that's not a slave? Well, Eved Hashem would be. Eliezer, whatever, but he is a slave in the. Leaving aside the questions about what other roles he played, Eved sounds like, you know, he was bought at some point. That is what it sounds like. Think of an example of someone who is an Eved Lamelech who is clearly not just a slave of the king. It's an interesting question. There you go. Not trivia at all. But Zakan takes this approach that it doesn't mean that he is a slave in the classic sense, but a slave of the king. But take a look at what he does here in source number 5, because he has to balance that, as you're going to see here. He says, the term slave in this context indicates that he was a servant of the king or a royal official, not, you know, somebody of low standing. However, he has to contend with the fact that Tobiah is not able to override Nehemiah. And he says that Tobiah did not approach the king directly appears to indicate that he was a Jew with no formal office, or that he was a non-Jewish aristocrat and governor who through marriage had undergone a form of conversion and had aligned himself with the Judean upper classes. He thinks he has to end up as a Jew somehow, whether that's because of the name Tobiah or not is unclear, but we know already that he has. People have sworn oath to him and so on. So he's clearly part of the Jewish hierarchy. In contemptuously labeling Tobiah a servant, Nehemiah was indicating that he was a renegade who practiced a syncretic form of Judaism that incorporated idolatrous practices. So the way he reads it is that Eved is a little bit of a slur. He's really a servant of the king, and Nehemiah, in writing the book, chooses to call him Eved in order to degrade him because he is an idolater. So now you have multiple ideas for what it means when we say Tobiah is an Eved, right? Either he's a slave, or he is a servant of the king, or he's a servant of a king and he's a syncretist, and therefore Nehemiah is insulting him by calling him Eved. However you slice it, Tobiah and Sanballat have reason not to like Nehemiah. Right? Sanballat is afraid of his power being threatened. And Tobiah also has some element of power here. People are swearing loyalty to him. And so he's concerned as well about Nehemiah's arrival. Now, take a look at Pasuk Yud, sentence 10 now. We're in chapter 2, sentence 10, where they find out that Nehemiah is here. Vayishma Sanballat ha-choroni v'tobiah ha-ebed ha-amoni. And again, Amoni, Ammonite, may refer to his biology. He's from Ammon. That would be a little bit unusual, just because at this point Sanherib has come along and scrambled all the nations, and I don't know who Ammon is. It could be he just lived in the area that had been the area of Ammon, and we just continue calling it that, much the same way that we saw last year, that there were those who called the Persians Babylonians, because they occupied the land that had been Babylonian land. So they hear about this. Vayera lahem ra'a gedola. They are very angry. Asher ba'a dam levakesh tova livnei Yisrael. Somebody has come along trying to help the Jews. How dare he? And so they don't want it. Whether that is, again, their issue of authority politically, or whether it is because it's the old hostility from the Samaritans and the Jews religiously, unclear. Certainly the politics have to be part of it. But they are not happy. At this point, they haven't done anything, though. That'll happen in another 10 verses at the end of the chapter. Right now, they've heard the news, they're unhappy. Now we shift gears to talk about Nehemiah. I came to Jerusalem, Nehemiah says. Va'ehisham yamim shlosha, and I was there for 3 days. Va'akum laila, and I got up at night. Ani va'anashim ma'ati me along with small group of men. V'lo higadati la'adam, ma'elokai nosena libi lasos liRushalayim. I didn't tell anybody what God had put into my heart. Note that reference. God had put into my heart. It's the religious identity of Nehemiah. I didn't want to tell anyone what God had put into my heart to do for Yerushalayim. Ubehema ein imi. And I did not have any animal with me. Ki ima behema asher ani rochev ba. Except the animal that I was riding. That's it. Okay. Let's take a look a little more closely at this. First of all, when did he arrive? Give a date? No. The answer is no. There's no date mentioned here. However, jump ahead to chapter 6, please, sentence 15. You see that? Vatishlam hachoma ve'esim v'chamisha le'elul. The wall was completed on the 25th of Elul. L'chamishim ushnayim yom. After 52 days of work. So work your way backwards. 52 days backwards from the 25th of Elul. You find that he arrived when? Roughly? Not knowing if it's a 30-day month, 29-day month, whatever. But he arrived at the start of the month of Av. Right? You have 29 days, roughly, 29 or 30 days in the month of Av, and then another 25 in Elul. Basically, he's there in the first couple of days of the month of Av. That's a really interesting thing. When did Ezra show up? Ezra left Babel in Nisan, just like Nehemiah did. right? Nehemiah, remember, spoke to the king in the beginning of Nisan. Well, it said Nisan. We thought it might be the beginning. Now ruins that whole discussion. But fundamentally, Nehemiah is mirroring Ezra's trip. You left in Nisan, and you arrive, as Ezra did, the start of Av. Ezra arrived on the first day of Av. Remember, we made that whole point about Aharon's yard site being the first day of Av, and Ezra being viewed as a reincarnation of sorts of Aharon, the great Kohen. So he arrives as Ezra did, and also, when you arrive in Av, that carries great resonance in terms of rebuilding, because the first temple is destroyed in the beginning of the month of Av, and now here we are, here to help out. This also may answer a question we asked back in Ezra. When Ezra took months for his trip from Nisan to Av, we asked, is that a reasonable length of time for him to take, or did he take a long time? And at the time, we didn't know. I even floated the idea that it could be Ezra being dramatic, because he likes drama, and it could be that he did it on purpose. Leave in Nisan, just like the Jews leaving Egypt, and arrive in Av, the time of rebuilding that destruction that occurred in Av. But now Nehemiah, who's traveling without an entourage, right? He doesn't have a large group of people. Josephus thinks he has a group of people, but no one else does. The book certainly doesn't say that. He just has whatever guards he has, and that's it. He has guards, right, but that's it. He shows up in the same length of time it took Ezra. It sounds like Ezra did not dally. It sounds like Ezra did well with his trip. So Nehemiah shows up, and after showing up, he takes a 3-day wait. Does that sound familiar? Well, you can find 3-day waits all through Tanakh. We've talked about that. But go back to Ezra chapter 8, sentence 15, please. This is when Ezra is gathering the people in Babel for his journey. Yep. He gathers everybody to the river, and they camp there for 3 days, but wait, we're not done. Jump ahead to chapter 8, sentence 32, when Ezra arrives in Israel. You see that? We came to Yerushalayim, Bnei Shev Sham, Yomim Shlosha. We stayed there for 3 days, and then we started doing the errands that we had been sent to do. So the 3-day trip, the 3-day wait seems to be something that Ezra does, and now Nehemiah is going to mirror. I wonder about this, actually. Yeah?
But we know that a lot of times in Tanakh, we say, like, so it means a few days, or it means a lot of days. It doesn't necessarily mean 3.
So in nowhere have I seen that it wouldn't mean 3, meaning you are right that there are many, many 3-day periods. We've talked about the significance of the 3-day period as a period of transition, right? We talk about it. Yonah is in the fish for 3 days. The Jews have 3 days at Har Sinai. Yeah. The 3 days before they get to Yam Suf and so on. But I don't recall anywhere that somebody actually says it doesn't really mean 3.
Oh, I just did.
Oh, okay. Now, Gita's commentary says it. If you could find someone to corroborate, I would be happy.
We'll use other numbers, and it'll mean...
What do you mean?
If they're trying to describe something that's very big, I have to dig up.
Oh, no, we have concepts of very large numbers being rounded off and that kind of an idea. But I'm saying within this particular idea of the 3-day period, mm-hmm. I think the 3-day period is dafka. I think there's a sense that you need 3 days to just recover from things. That's the way I would look at this use here. And what I was going to say is that the 3 days reminds me of the Gemara. The Gemara talks about somebody who comes in from a long trip not davening for 3 days. You shouldn't daven for 3 days. Rashi says that was his practice. You can't properly focus for 3 days after coming in from a long journey. I don't recommend this as a practice today, simply because, number one, our journeys are not as arduous as people riding on a donkey for a few hundred miles, coming from Babel. And number two, because if we're really going to wait until we get that kind of concentration they're talking about, we're going to be there more than 3 days. But the idea of it is meant to reflect that you need Yishuv Hadas. You need a certain settled mind in order to daven, and 3 days gives you that, and maybe that's really what's going on here. Maybe that's the image. Ezra says, you know what, I need 3 days to collect myself before I can go do what I'm supposed to do. Nehemiah also needs 3 days before he's going to go off and start doing what he's about to do. So he embarks on a tour after the 3 days.
At night.
Sorry?
At night.
at night, right, with a small group of people and only animals to ride on. Why is he doing this in secret? And it is in secret. It's at night. He doesn't want anybody to know. Why is that? So one view, and I think the straightforward explanation is because the Samaritans, right? The Samaritans are dangerous. He doesn't need a problem from them. And he figures, don't tell anybody what you're going to do. There's no reason to give them intelligence on where I am and what I'm doing. Let them wonder for a bit. I think that's the straight read. And that's what I would have said is the beginning, middle, and end of why he's being so secretive. But we're going to see a Rashi who's going to flip everything. And he's going to give you a wildly different view of what's going on. We're not there yet. Yeah?
The Shomer Nimr in Jerusalem?
So the Shomer Nimr are technically north, but they clearly have connections. All these people have sworn loyalty to Tovia, right? So they clearly have connections, and they are concerned about Nehemiah's influence in Jerusalem. So I think they have some kind of control, the extent of it I'm not sure of. So now we find out about the tour that he took. He's riding an animal. There are no other animals, it appears. Everybody else is not on animals. And let's look at what he does, what his route is. Va'itzah, Pasuk Chayud Gimel, chapter 2, sentence 13. Va'itzah b'shar ha'gai laila. I am going to follow here the Dat Mikra's way of explaining these different locations. I am certain that there are other ways to explain the locations, but the Dat Mikra gave me a coherent image of what's going on, and I haven't found anybody else who does. So I'm going to go with what the Dat Mikra suggests as the points along this route. We start out with Sha'ar Hagai. So Sha'ar Hagai is southwest Jerusalem, according to the Dat Mikra. It is facing a place known as Gei Ben Hinnom. Gei Ben Hinnom is famous from Yeshaya and Malachim as a place of Moloch worship. They worshipped idols there, gave their children over between the fire. That's Gei Ben Hinnom. And yes, that's the origin of the name Gehenim. For hell, it's off of Gei Ben Hinnom. So he says, I departed from the entrance by the Gai. A Gai is sort of a valley, a depression in the land. So I went out from that gate in, again, southwest Jerusalem, Laila, at night. Ve'el pnei ein hatanin. Towards the face of Ein Hatanin. Ein Hatanin, according to Professor Zer Kavod, is a spring that's found in Gei Ben Hinnom, or some suggest it's associated with Ein Rogel, which is in the southeast. So he's now going from the southwest, moving his way towards the southeast. Ve'el Shar Ha'ashbot, towards Shar Ha'ashbot, southeast of the city. The Dat Mikra has some suggestions about how you get the name Shar Ha'ashbot. Ashpa literally is trash. Ashpa is trash. So some suggest that's in fact what it was. This was the local dump. The others suggest that it was right near the cattle market. And the, sorry?
Dung Gate, yeah.
Yeah, the Dung Gate, because that was where the cattle market was. That's another suggestion. Yeah, today there was a Shar Ha'ashbot. Right, today we have one.
It's next to the Kotel.
No. He actually suggests here in the Dat Mikra footnote that this is about 700 meters south of today's southern gate of the old city, which is called Shar Ha'ashbot. So he thinks this is about 700 meters south of today's Shar. Clearly today's Shar is named for this one, and that's obvious. So he's working his way east. From the southwest, he's working his way along the southern wall of the city. And here we get a key word. I don't want to hear commentary, I just want your translation. Va'ehi sover b'chomot Yerushalayim. And I was blank. Thinking, is that what it says?
Contemplating.
Okay, so there, like with a samach, right? Anybody have a translation that's not the stone Tanakh here? I was viewing. Okay, but taking it along the same lines. That it's to view, to absorb, to take in, to digest.
Break,
No. I asked for not for the commentary, I asked for the translation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's right. You'll see why I say that. I am observing the walls of Jerusalem, which makes sense. That's what he has to do in order to figure out what to do. Asher heim prutsim, which were broken through, ushareho uklu ba'esh, and its gates have been consumed by fire. So I'm studying the walls as I go along. Pasuk Yudalit, sentence 14. We're going to come back to still there. Va'evor el shar ha'ayin. I crossed to Sha'ar Ha'ayin. Some say this is the southeast where Gihon terminates in the Silwan Pool. Right? The Silwan is off to the east-southeast of the Old City. Others say this is Ein Rogel. Sha'ar Ha'ayin, and Ayin is a spring. So that's the only real definitive point that we have, and then everything else we're just playing with. Yeah?
So is that the Sihon? Stream of water?
Oh, Gihon. It's not the one, it's Gihon. You're asking if it's one of those Gan Eden bodies of water from Bereishis?
No.
1 second, is that what you're asking? Yeah, no, Gihon is a body of water. That's for sure. Whether it's meant to be the one that's from the four rivers surrounding the Garden of Eden is a good question. But this is by the Silwan, somewhere southeast of the Old City. And he says, Ve'el Brechat HaMelech, to Brechat HaMelech, the king's pool, the edge of the Silwan. This is going to show up in a slightly different version in chapter 3. Ve'ein makom la'beheima la'avor tachtai. But there's nowhere at this point for the animal to get through. I'm stuck because of the ruins, the stones that are in the way on the ground. I can't ride any further. Vayhi olev v'nachal laila. So what did I do? I went up the nachal at night. Nachal here is assumed to be Nachal Kidron, which now takes you towards the north, still east. Vayhi sover b'choma. There's that word again. I am observing, viewing, taking in the wall. Va'ashuv va'avo b'shar hagai va'ashuv. And then I went back and I came to Shar Hagai, the starting point, va'ashuv, and I went back. That's the tour. Okay, clear? In terms of what he has done, he has gone through the southern wall, west to east, worked his way up the east side, trying to get towards the north, and he can't get any further, and so he goes back to where he started. So take a look now at source number 7, please. Sorry?
Where was he going?
He was trying to check the walls. He wanted to do a survey of the walls of Yerushalayim. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right. That's what he wants to do. Okay. So take a look at source number 7, the first part of what the Malbim has to say. Vayitzav Shar Hagai. I went out at Shar Hagai. I departed at Shar Hagai. He says, Sham Haya Beit Nechemya. He says, that's where Nechemya's house is. Remember we talked about that, how he got wood for his house? Vizem Vuari Tev, and he says, I'll prove it to you. Because in chapter 12 we're going to see, Shashtei Todot Halcha Achas Liyamin L'Shar HaShpot V'Shenit L'Smol L'Migdala Tanurim. He says, we're going to talk about the dedication of the city in chapter 12 when they finish the walls, and they're going to have two thanks offerings, and one of them is going to walk to the right, to the Shar HaShpot, and the other one to the left, to what's called Migdala Tanurim. And there, Mivawar, it is explained, Sheshtehen Yatzu Mishar Hagai, that both of them emerged from Shar Hagai, which is then Bein Migdala Tanarim L'Shar HaAshpot, actually between those two locations, right? In other words, the two of them are emerging from Shar Hagai, one goes to Migdala Tanarim, the other goes to Shar HaAshpot. Obviously then Shar Hagai is in the middle. V'yatzu Misham, and why did they come from there? Mibnei Shesham Haya, Beit HaPacha, because that was where the Pacha's house was. And then he goes on to say, Shar Hagai is in the west, and he left his house heading south, and this is consistent with what the Da Mikra thought. Clear? So far? Again, all he's telling you is that Nehemiah starts his journey in the southwest where his house is. But now we have to talk about what it means when it says he was Sover Vachoma, and it's mentioned a couple of times. So the standard read, and this is the way Ibn Ezra takes it, is the way your translations have it. Which is to say, he's examining the wall. Good. However, that's an unusual word in Tanakh. It's really an Aramaic word. to be honest. It wouldn't be the only Aramaic word to make it into Tanakh, and it's not so crazy. Aramaic is a product of Hebrew and Arabic, so why shouldn't there be Hebrew / Aramaic words? It's certainly not beyond the pale. Having said that, there are others who say no. The word should be read as shover, to break. So I would have thought, why would you break the stones so that you can get through? Right? I'm walking around the walls, and I need a way to get through, and so I need to break whatever's in my way. But that's not what it said. What did it say he broke? The walls of Jerusalem. So the Malbim offers you an explanation. Still in source number 7, the last line we have there. Vayehi sover, or shover, nira sheratza lenasos imachoma hayishena shenishara chazaka shelo yitzarchu lesosra. He wanted to see whether the remaining wall was strong, such that you wouldn't need to demolish it, but you could just patch it. That's what he wants to know. Can you just fill in the gaps and your wall will be fine? So he's testing the wall and trying to break it and seeing how it does. That's one explanation. And then Malvin goes on to quote Ibn Ezra, and he likes what Ibn Ezra has to say as well. That's another take. He's being technically savvy, in other words. Nehemiah is not only someone who communicates with God, but he's sharp. And he says, we may not need to tear everything down and start again. We might be able to preserve some of the old. Yeah.
Is the wall he's talking about the same one that we're familiar with today?
I don't believe so. I believe that the wall that we are familiar with is built later. Anybody know definitively? I'm pretty sure it's of later origin, but okay. I think that's the case.
It was built by Herod.
Well, Herod is much later.
Yeah, that's
right. Right, Herod's the other end of this temple. Yeah. So you have the standard read. I'm examining the wall. You have the Malvim's read. He's testing it to see how much of it is usable in the new construction. And then you get Rashi. And this is what made me think Nehemiah is awesome. We're going to see more about him. But look at this, number 8. He talks about why it is that they don't want to have everybody find out what's going on. The few people who were with me, they went on foot. I alone rode an animal. They did not want to ride their horses. So that they could get out in secret without people knowing. V'hem holchu lishbor ulahapil chomos ha'ir balayla. What they were trying to do was damage the wall further. They wanted to knock down the wall. They wanted to build, to not build, to increase the number of gaps. That way everybody would look and say, the wall's in terrible shape. We gotta build.
That's true.
Isn't that great? That's why they did it at night. They didn't want to get caught increasing the damage. Right? This is like the prototypical false flag operation. Right? You're gonna demolish the wall. The Israeli ingenuity. You're going to demolish the wall in order that people should then be on board with the idea that they should rebuild it. I'm impressed. I'm impressed by this idea. I don't know if this says more about Rashi than about Nehemiah. In terms of coming up with this idea. He's reading it as shover. That's exactly right. He's reading it as shover. And that would explain the emphasis on the word in the text. Meaning, he says it not once, right? He says, I was shover, and then he goes on and he says, I was shover, right? Or sover, again, depending on what you see here. But that's the idea, is he's actually increasing the damage in order to get everybody on board. Tricky is one word. Nehemiah is cool. Okay. Yeah. So let's see what happens. Pasuk Tet Zayin, sentence 16. V'hasganim lo yad'u anu halachti. I didn't even tell my sganim. The sganim are the assistants he's been provided with, right? His deputies. He hasn't told them where he's going. Uman yasa. I sure didn't tell him what I was doing at this point. V'la yehudim, v'la kohanim, v'la chorim, v'la sganim, u'li yeser osei amalacha, ad kein lo yigadati. Not to the general population of Judea, not to the kohanim, not to the chorim, the aristocracy, not to the Sganim, the deputies, and the rest of the people who would be doing the work. None of them. Ad kein lo higadati. I had not told them a thing about what was going on. V'omar aleihem, and now I told them. Pasuk Yud Zayin. Atem ro'im hara'ah asher anachnu va. You see the bad state we are in. Asher Yerushalayim Charefa, the city is in ruins. Ushareha nitzisu ba'esh, its walls have been burned in fire. L'chu v'nivneas chomas Yerushalayim v'lo nehiya od cherpa. Let's build a wall. Let's go build up the wall of Yerushalayim, and we will no longer be put to shame. The Zakheim book notes that there are different points being made here. How many different points do you see Nehemiah making?
In one sentence or the twelve?
In this sentence here.
Okay.
In Pasuk Yud Zayin. Right now you see three. Where do you see three, Gita?
You see the evil that's happened in front of us is one.
Mm-hmm.
What the place looks like. We're going to go rebuild it, and we will no longer be embarrassed.
Right, but the motivations for building are really twofold here. Right, there are two different things going on. Janine, you were going to say?
No.
Okay.
I thought Loniel was just. It's part of the same second point.
Right. So the way that Zakheim looks at it, and I think he's right, is first of all vulnerability. The ra'ah that we are in means the vulnerability that we are in, as seen in the destruction of these walls. And there's also the humiliation. We are in disgrace. You know, it's terrible that we are in this kind of a situation. You know what it reminds me of? Is Yerushalmi. Purim is not that far away, right? Hanukkah is next week. He created a little bit. He didn't do a whole thing. He had gotten a report already about damage. Let's be fair. But there's a lot of discussion surrounding Shushan Purim, right? Shushan Purim is created initially because on the 14th day of Adar, the people in Shushan continue to fight. Right, 13th day of Adar, everybody's fighting. 14th day of Adar, Shushan continues to fight, and their break comes on the 15th. So they observe Purim on the 15th day of Adar. However, we don't say that. We say that Shushan Purim is observed wherever there was a wall at the time of when? Has to have a wall, Mimot Yoshua bin Nun. It has to have a wall from the time of Yoshua, in order for us to read the Megillah on Shushan Purim in that city. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I understand if you want to tell me that we're going to observe Shushan Purim in Shushan, because that's where they had that kind of a break. And even if you're going to expand it to cities that had walls in the times of Shushan, because the distinction is drawn in the Megillah between Arei HaPrazot, the cities that were open, and then you have walled cities. So I get the idea that you're going to expand from Shushan to walled cities. But why cities that had a wall in the time of Yoshua? You know how many centuries that is before Purim? Who cares if they had a wall in the time of Yoshua? Says the Yerushalmi. Because if you did it, those cities that had a wall from the time of Purim, Yerushalayim would be excluded. Because it doesn't have a wall, as we see here. We didn't have a wall at that point. And it's considered to be shameful to have a city that doesn't have a wall. So there's the element not only of vulnerability, but there's also the element of shame that's present, and that here Nehemiah is playing on for them. Not only are we vulnerable, but we are also in humiliation. So two separate arguments. And then he continues in Pasuk Yud Chet, sentence 18. Va'agid lahem, I told them, es yad elokai asher hi tova alai, the hand of God that was good to me, ve'af divrei hamelach asher amar li, and the words of the king that he told me, I told them that too. Vayomru nakumu vaninu vayechazku yideihem latova. They said, let's go build, and vayechazku yideihem latova. I'm going to come back to that phrase. But first of all, notice he added two other elements. God is with us, and the king is on our side. So he has given them four arguments now for building. Right? Number one is we are vulnerable. Number two is we are in humiliation. Number three is Hashem is with us. And number four, the empire is on our side. The king is with us. And therefore, vayechazku yideihem latova, that's a hard phrase to translate. Ibn Ezra says, they came on board happy about the tova that God had done for them. Tova meaning God's benefit.
Who's the they? The ones in...
All the people who he's now talking to and telling this story to. We don't get names. We aren't told specifics of who it is. It could be those people, but I don't think it's a given. But one way to look at it is that tova is the good God has done for us. The other way, Mitzudat David, is that it's the good they're going to do. They strengthen their hands to do good by building. And that brings us back to the start of our unit here. And good old Sanballat. Vayishma Sanballat ha-Horoni, v'tovia ha-Eved ha-Amoni, v'geshem ha-Arvi. Three people now. Right? They're multiplying. Sanballat, Tovia, and now Geshem ha-Arvi. So Zakham, on page 75 in his book, I didn't bring it here, quotes an inscription that identifies Geshem as the ruler of Kedar. That's a really important point. Because Kedar is south and east of Judea. So now you have a problem. Right? Sanballat and presumably Tovia are to your north. Geshem is to your south and east. You now face a potential two-front battle. Right? Now you have a problem. So so Sanballat, Tovia, and Geshem are now all against us. Vayaligu lanu, they mocked us. Vayivzu aleinu, they heaped disgrace upon us. Vayomru, and they said, Ma davar azera sharatem osim, what are you doing? Ha'alam melech atem mordim, are you rebelling against the king by building this? Right? Who do you think you are coming along to build? By what right do you build? And this is a point of intimidation. You now have armies potentially on both sides who are going to attack you. So look at what Nehemiah says back. Pasukhav, and this is the other Nehemiah is awesome moment. Vashivo sam davar, I answered them, Vamarlam, and I said to them, Elokei Hashemayim hu yatzliach lanu. The God of heaven is the one who will bring us success. Va'anachnu avadav, we are his servants. Nakumu v'aninu, we're going to get up and build. And as far as you, v'lachem en chelek utzdaka v'zikaron b'Yerushalayim, you don't have a say. You have no portion here. You have no tzedakah. We have to come back to that word. You have no zikaron. You don't even get mentioned in this city. He stands up to them, in other words. The Jews at this point here are living in fear of those around them. They're under attack. Their walls are being burned, and they don't seem to have any defense at all. Ezra, whatever he's doing right now, is not leading them in defense. No, Ezra. We don't see him. He's not mentioned. He's going to show up for chapters and chapters, even though, if we read the book chronologically, he's already present. We don't know what he's doing. The Jews are intimidated by those around them. Nehemiah hears the challenge from the north and the challenge from the south, and he says, if you have an issue, take it up with Shushan. Right? You can go back to the king if you like and see what he has to say. But you don't have any control of what happens in Yerushalayim. Yes?
These are the new Jews who came with Ezra? Or the
yeah.
The old Jews who were there before?
Anybody. Anybody and everybody. It's Ezra's group and those before. Yeah. Few, scattered, weak, all of the above.
He doesn't mention the king. He just mentions that.
Right, but he says, you have no say. By saying you have no say, right, take a look at Tzidat David.
He doesn't say the king is with us.
No, but he says you have no say. That's what it would mean. I mean, take a look at Tzidat David, because that's where I got the idea from.
The king is with us.
Right, take a look at number 9 for a second. Avin tashinu lamelech. Even if you're going to complain to the king, lomar kadverim ela, saying such things, lo yoilu divrechem lashbis hamalacha. You're not going to be able to stop this from happening. Ki Hashem yatzliach lanu. I think that what drives the Tzedat David here is the fact that in the previous sentence they invoked the king. You are rebelling against the throne, and he says, deal with it. Sharon.
2:7, the end of 2:7, and for the walls of the city, some letter from for Esau, the keeper of the king's forest. So he came with permission.
Yeah.
Build the walls of the city.
You got it. And that's how he knows, as he told the people, God, you know, the empire is in me. It's not just that God is on my side.
Formerly, remember, they have to go look in the archives for the letter.
Yes. Right. No, he's got it all in him.
I'm talking about that I've got the letter.
Right. He hasn't said that.
No.
He just says, look, you can go complain if you want. Go talk to the landlord. That's correct. Now, this business about tzedakah is an interesting point. He says, you have no tzedakah. So I think what we'll do is we'll start with that, God willing, next time. And then we'll launch right into Paragimel, into Chapter 3, and the work being done on the walls. But no, this is not the last we've heard of Sanballat. He ain't done. Good.
Thank you.